funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who were the young men and women who sparked the Arab Spring, and how did they do it? Old regimes were replaced in Egypt, Tunisia, and Libya, and it appears the era of Presidents for Life may be drawing to an end throughout the Middle East. And as my guest will tell us, while revolutionary efforts have not fully achieved the goals of true justice and democracy, the youth generation that set these changes in motion is still coming of age and can be expected to do great things in the decades to come. Juan Cole is professor of history at the University of Michigan. His new book is called The New Arabs: How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. Juan, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much.
Let's start with this. Is the Arab Spring still ongoing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, these young people who began these revolutions in 2011 had kicked off long-term processes. So we'll be seeing the echoes of this for literally decades.
Tell us a little bit about the tremendous youth bulge in the region. How large is the population of millennials in the Arab world, and how are they different from their parents and grandparents?
Well, the millennial generation is enormous. We think it's maybe as much as
40% of the some 370 million Arabs.
Wow. And in terms of the differences between them and the generations that have come before, culturally, socially, religiously, talk about that, please.
The surveys that have been done suggest that these young people are much more urban. They're almost completely literate. They're often wired. And they are somewhat less religiously observant than their elders.
Is that not something that is typical of young people the world over, and then sometimes they become more religiously observant as they age? Can we expect that?
It doesn't seem to be that that's the pattern. That is to say, their elders were more religious when they were young. Mm-hmm. So there just seems to be a generational difference here.
So you mentioned that this generation of millennials in the Middle East is almost entirely literate. What kind of education has been available to them? How much learning do they have?
Well, the post-colonial states in the region that were established after World War II and after the age of European colonialism ended were very invested in education. And so their parents' generation really was the first to go to school on a massive scale. And now these young people are living in societies where there's virtually universal primary education and often secondary, and a certain number of them go to university. So just to give you an example, Libya in the late 1960s was 80% illiterate. It's now the reverse. It's 80% literate. And among the 15 to 29-year-olds, literacy is almost universal. So this is a night and day kind of situation.
So is there a pretty significant generation gap in terms of culture?
Absolutely. Not only with regard to, reading and newspaper culture and so forth, but also with regard to the internet. Young people in the Arab world who are wired, and a majority are, talk about the difficulty in explaining themselves to their parents. There's definitely a completely different youth culture. Arab society is still relatively patriarchal. There's a patriarch of the family, and one is supposed to obey him. Both the female members and the younger members of the family are supposed to take their cues from him. And of course, in real life, it doesn't always work out that way. But these young people are much less likely to, let us say, be obedient than their elders were.
Talk a little bit about how the internet and cable television and other kinds of media have given these young people a view of the world outside their own countries.
Well, this is something that's very different from their parents' generation. When I first went to the Arab world in the early 70s, there typically was a single national television station, and what was on it was decided by the regime. And they often spent 10 minutes, 15 minutes just lovingly panning the camera over the leader sitting on this Louis the 14th chair and with a visiting dignitary. And that was television. Now this generation has satellite access. They have the internet. They follow cultural and political developments in Europe and the United States. One young person said it's as though you could download an entire lifetime of experience in only 2 years. Some of them download films that have subtitles and teach themselves English in this way.
And they had some experience trying to get around government censorship even before they became politically active, right? They were just curious about the world and they figured out ways to bypass official censors.
Yes, the dictatorial Arab regimes like the one in Tunisia were very controlling of people. And so the young people initially stumbled into the cyber police really mainly for cultural activities. This was also true, in meat space, because, for instance, the soccer fans are often in Egypt and Tunisia are somewhat rowdy, and they would clash with the police. And so that section of the young people that were really into soccer developed a kind of enmity with the regime. And then if you were into certain, areas of the internet that the government didn't approve of, you'd constantly be getting these 404 not found errors. In Tunisia, they even characterized those errors as a person. They called him Amar 404, and they really hated him.
What's interesting is that it would seem as if totalitarian regimes would simply forbid the internet, but I guess there was too much commercial potential for that to have been considered viable.
That's my theory about it. I just note that, say, in Tunisia, the regime of Zinedine Ben Ali seems to have started making plans to sell things over the internet through, government-backed companies or companies belonging to the royal, the presidential family, I should say, I think they kind of thought that they had an opportunity to become the Jeff Bezos, the Amazon of the Middle East, and so they were unwilling to forego the possibility of enriching themselves through the internet. But it had this unfortunate side effect of allowing widespread free speech, which the regime was very much against.
What sort of an influence has a network like Al Jazeera had on the way that individuals, millennials in particular, in the Arab world, understand their own lives and the lives of their neighbors in countries nearby?
Well, Al Jazeera and some other independent satellite television channels, we're not under the control of any of these regimes. And there were always ways to get them either on the internet or on satellite. And there were workarounds around censorship. And there was a kind of dialectic or a back and forth. So when the web developed the ability to display video around 2004, 2005, young people started posting videos of things like police torture that they captured on the internet. And then Al Jazeera, which is based in Qatar, which is a small, out-of-the-way country in many ways and not beholden to any of these regimes, would pick that footage up from the internet and broadcast it over satellite, and sometimes would send out reporters to do follow-up stories. So the bloggers and the vloggers, the people who put up video, and the international television satellite channels sort of played off one another and created, I think, a real crescendo of public outrage over some of these issues like police torture.
Historian Juan Cole joins us today from the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C. We're talking about his new book, The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Juan Cole, professor of history at the University of Michigan and author of the new book, The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Juan, given the traditionally patriarchal culture of the Middle East, have you been surprised at the activism of young women in these movements?
The young women have been really remarkable. We estimate that a good fifth of the crowd at Tahrir Square in January and February of 2011, which helped overthrow the dictator Hosni Mubarak, was made up of women, mainly young women. And, of course, they were entering into a kind of no man's land, a frontier. There were no police, and there were all these youth, and many were in tents and spending the night. They didn't want the police to be able to clear the space at night. So it was quite brave of them to be out there. And, of course, there were instances of sexual harassment and even rape. But about a fifth were out in the streets. But in addition to their presence in the streets and as leaders of some of these processions and marches, they also played an outsized role on the internet. And in a gender segregated society like the Arab world, where public space is largely coded as male, and women can come into the public only under certain circumstances. On the internet, however, there are no such rules. And so young women who made impassioned speeches and rants on YouTube or who organized chat rooms and so forth could emerge as leaders, and they did in very large numbers.
What is the relationship between these youth activists and traditional political parties and organizations?
These were dictatorships. They weren't exactly one-party states because they did allow a few token opposition parties. And in some instances, you know, as many as a fifth of the seats in parliament would be held by the opposition. But, of course, the opposition couldn't really be an opposition. It couldn't go very far in its criticism of government policy publicly. And being allowed into parliament was a kind of bribe for these parties to cooperate with the ruling dictatorship. And there was a thumb on the till so that, the ruling party was never in any danger of losing at least an overwhelming majority of the seats. So these parties were kind of tamed by the system for the most part, and the youth didn't have much respect for them. I asked one young Tunisian activist, who identified herself as a leftist, what did you think of the Socialist Party? She said, I'm quite sure we despise the Socialist Party. But what she meant by that was that, they were part of the old system. And the same thing was true in Egypt. So when some of these parties did start trying to play more of an oppositional role in Egypt in 2005, 2006, and they organized youth wings to help with demonstrations and so forth, I was told by one of the activists that the youth tried to network laterally, horizontally, beyond these parties and tried to avoid allowing any of these old-time kind of opposition parties, typically parties of left-of-center bent, to take over the youth movement. They wanted to maintain their independence.
You talk about even the old regimes allowing for the presence of a token opposition. I'm thinking now, though, of a country like Egypt, where in the most recent elections, the president won with something like, I guess, officially 97% of the vote. That doesn't really speak to legitimate elections or democracy, does it?
No. Egypt has backslid, and it's not a good scene right now. To be fair, however, there was an opponent in that election of the figure who won is General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, came out of the military. He did have an opponent, and his opponent actually had done fairly well in the 2012 first round of the presidential elections, had gotten about a fifth of the votes in the country. And so, it's not very much to hang on to, but for the most part, Hosni Mubarak, the dictator who ruled from 1981, and his predecessors didn't have opponents. Mostly they just had referendums, which you can't lose. The new president is limited by the new constitution to 2 4-year terms. Mubarak, was a president for life, and indeed was making plans to hand over the country to his son after him. So, you can't say that the terms of politics haven't changed at all. But of course, it is shameful that this election was conducted the way it was and had this result. There will be parliamentary elections, and although one of the major parties in the country, the Muslim Brotherhood, has now been banned, it appears that there will be a fair amount of pluralism in the parliamentary elections, and the president doesn't have a party, so it's not clear how he would dominate those parliamentary elections. And when I was in Egypt in March, a lot of activists were telling me that they weren't paying too much attention to the presidential election, which was kind of a foregone deal, but that they did have some hopes for a new parliament emerging, which would be multiple in its voices. And in the new constitution, the parliament is somewhat strengthened in its powers. So, from an evolutionary point of view, there may be some hope of Egypt gradually moving in a more pluralist and democratic direction.
So often in these countries, it is very important for the leader to have cooperation from the military. And generally, militaries are made up of young people. Has there been any sign that military organizations are sort of at least emotionally siding with these millennial activists?
Well, the military in Tunisia very obviously sided with the activists. The story is told that President Zinedine Ben Ali in mid-January of 2011 called his chief of staff, Rashid Ammar, and said, General, you're just going to have to shoot these protesters. And the general is said to have looked the president in the eye and said, Mr. President, I'm not going to shoot the Tunisian people for you. And that was probably the end of Ben Ali. The Tunisian military is small, but there are reports of, there were different kinds of security organizations. So there were secret police, essentially, who were beating up the protesters in provincial towns. And in one town, Kasserine, there's a report of the army actually coming in and siding with the protesters against the secret police. There was a little bit of a danger of, you know, civil war type of stuff going on. And that was why I think the elite decided that Ben Ali had to go. In Egypt, Egypt's military is about 75,000 professional troops, and you have, you know, the typical kind of Republican guards, tank corps and so forth, who are professional. But then about 350,000 troops are conscripts, and, you know, young men in Egypt come in for 2 or 3 years and cycle back out. And so a military like that, which has such a large conscript element, is difficult to deploy for crowd control because, as you say, you know, a lot of these young soldiers were in classes with the protesters the previous year in high school and might be unwilling to fire on them. And so the Egyptian officer corps came out on television in the middle of the Egyptian revolution in 2011 and just said, you know, we're not going to attack the Egyptian people. And they forestalled any attempt of the regime to deploy the army for that purpose. Now, there were occasional clashes between the military and the crowds just because the military was doing crowd control to some extent. But for the most part, the military in Egypt kind of declared itself neutral. And that role for the military is what tended to produce relatively soft landings for these countries like Egypt and Tunisia, which didn't go into massive violence, where, as in Libya or in Syria, the officer corps was very closely tied to the regime and where the military was more professional. It was willing to attack the people, and then that turns the thing into a civil war.
Have you seen a lot of evidence of greater tolerance for religious diversity among this generation than previous ones?
Oh, absolutely. Certainly among the activists. And I should, you know, say that I'm really focusing not on the entire generation, which has all kinds of people in it,
sure,
obviously, but among the youth who organize themselves as what they call youth movements and who say that they speak for the aspirations and the grievances of a generation. Those youth movements typically put a big premium on religious freedom. For instance, in Tahrir Square in 2011, Coptic Christian youth joined in the attempt to overthrow Mubarak. Christians in Egypt often are lower class or live in slums. There is a Christian middle class, but the ones who came out probably were from Shobra, which is a slummy area. And on the Friday after the revolution began, when the Muslim youth had Friday prayers, you know, you're vulnerable when you're praying, and the Coptic Christian youth formed a circle around them to protect them from any attempt to attack them on the part of the secret police. And then the following Sunday, the Christians held Mass in Tahrir Square, and the Muslim youth protected them. And so there was a great deal of cross-sectarian harmony among the revolutionaries. And in Tunisia, when hardline Salafi Muslims, and they are a very tiny group in Tunisia, chanted against the Tunisian Jews, because there is a small Tunisian Jewish community still, the activist youth denounced them and organized to protect the Jews of Tunisia. So they put a premium on this kind of thing, and it's not just religious freedom, but also ethnic diversity. The old Arab nationalist line of their parents tended to downplay the rights of ethnic minorities like the Amazigh or Berbers. In Libya, after the revolution, the youth celebrated that the Amazigh had more freedom to express their culture.
How is the situation with youth unemployment in the region today, and what effect do you think that might have on the progress of youth revolutionary movements in the next few years?
Youth unemployment is one of the reasons for the revolutions, mm-hmm. and it's still an unsolved problem. And it's a problem especially for educated youth. These countries, you know, like Tunisia would claim an unemployment rate of 14%, but we think it's double that. Mm. Of course, a lot of people are not counted as unemployed if they stop looking for a job. That's true even in the United States. But among educated youth, the unemployment rate might be actually as high as 25 or 30%. This is in part an artifact of the big demographic bulge. I mean, obviously you have in the Arab world literally millions of people turning 18 every year or 22 and going out and looking for a job. And it's hard to provide them with jobs when there are so many of them. But in addition to which, the Arab world suffers from very low rates of investment compared to even India or Indonesia or other places with high levels of growth, population growth. So there's an economic problem here of corruption and poor governance discouraging investment.
Compare this movement to others that have taken place, revolutionary movements. You write about the Czech Republic and the changes there, or Czechoslovakia. And it took decades, really, for the first seeds to grow into anything that had much power.
Yes, I mean, this is just a cautionary tale that I tell because I think there's a tendency for outside observers to look at the high politics and not to see the underlying changes that are going on in this generation. And actually, the high politics really have been conducted by the Arab baby boomers, by typically men in their 60s. And the baby boomer generation is very different in its political ideals than the youth. And I just point out that, you know, there was a Prague Spring in 1968, in which people in Czechoslovakia yearned for a move away from Stalinism, and the Soviet regime of Brezhnev sent in tanks and crushed it. And as the tanks were moving on Prague, there was a young man, Václav Havel, who was a playwright, who was on a kind of pirate radio, who was encouraging the Prague Spring, and he was arrested, and he was not allowed to put on his plays. At one point, he was reduced to working in a brewery. And then, after 1989, he emerges as president of the Czech Republic. So you can't read off from 3 years what the future of the region is, and I think these youth have demonstrated that they are capable of organizing and insisting and changing things. People ask me sometimes, well, why didn't they form governments in the aftermath? Well, they were 20. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not. Most of them are not old enough to stand for parliament. So that kind of parliamentary politics is not what they're about yet, inevitably given their age. But it will be. And in 10, 20, 30 years, we'll begin to see them in politics.
Juan Cole is my guest. He's professor of history at the University of Michigan and author of The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Juan Cole, professor of history at the University of Michigan and author of The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. I want to talk a little bit about reverberations into countries that did not see regime change. For example, Iran now has a rather moderate president as of June of last year. Can you talk about whether there is a relationship between the selection of Hassan Rouhani and the Arab Spring?
I think that the regime in Iran, and I should underline that Iran is not an Arab country, it's not one of the countries I treated in my book, but it's certainly in the Middle East and had a close perch upon which to observe these developments and had its own youth rebellion in the summer of 2009. I think the regime in Iran interfered with the election in 2009, and that helped provoke the reaction against it and the rise of the Youth Green Movement in Iran. I think that the hardliners decided not to intervene in the 2013 election. A dark horse candidate, one that obviously wasn't favored by the supreme leader or by the hardliners, was able to be elected. And so, you know, that was probably a negative effect or a reaction to the youth movements, in the sense that the regime had been put on notice that if it went too far in interfering with the people's expectation that politics should be legitimate, that there would be a very substantial backlash. And despite their dictatorial tendencies, they decided that they didn't want to risk that.
It's no small thing that countries throughout the region are at least paying attention to the way their policies are to be viewed by the people that they govern.
Yes, I think that's right. I think, you know, your question was about places that were influenced by the Arab Spring that didn't actually have a revolution or the president wasn't overthrown. I think about Morocco in this regard. There's a relatively young king there who I think is much more savvy than his father had been. Morocco is kind of it's a constitutional monarchy on paper, but the king is very powerful. And so they did a new constitution in the wake of the Arab Spring revolts in 2011, which was voted in by referendum. And again, on paper, it actually has some good points. The king promises to appoint the prime minister from the party that got the most seats in parliament. Hmm. Well, that wasn't the case before. The king could appoint a technocrat or really anybody he liked as prime minister, regardless of the vote of the people. And so there was at least a baby step towards popular sovereignty involved in all that. And then the new constitution regularizes the position as citizens of the Berber or Amazigh community in Morocco, I think in dramatic ways. And my Amazigh friends are much happier about their political situation in Morocco now in the wake of this new constitution. So it's not perfect, and a lot of it is still only on paper and not implemented very well. You can't say there's been no change.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to the phones now and speak with John in Dallas. Hello, John.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thank you.
Good. I actually have two questions. One's really quick. The first one is to the professor. Professor, have you read Lee Harris? He wrote the book Civilization and Its Enemies. Second question is, you're talking about the youth movements and their ideals, and I was wondering, and again for the professor, if you have seen these youth movements go against their own ideals And if you could give examples of that and how that happens and possibly why that might happen. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thanks so much. Well, let me stick with the second question because it pertains to the book we're discussing. The youth organizations that I'm talking about have been pretty consistent in their ideals, but the youth as a whole, the youth who are willing to come out, maybe aren't organization people, have sometimes been fickle. And so, for instance, in the past year, we've seen a pretty fierce crackdown by the Egyptian government on the Muslim Brotherhood and on some of the youth movements themselves, who are secular in character. And many youth in Egypt were happy about the crackdown, let us say. They viewed the Muslim Brotherhood as a grasping and manipulative and covert cult that had managed to worm its way into power, and were very happy to see it repressed. And the activist youth, the ones who predominantly had been important in making the 2011 revolution against Hosni Mubarak, didn't agree. They had been pragmatists. They had been willing to cooperate with the Muslim Brotherhood in some ways, although they did also join in the demand that President Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood step down or subject himself to a recall election. They were not happy about the military crackdown on the Brotherhood, or the banning of the Brotherhood, or the declaring of it as a terrorist organization, which it obviously had not been. And so some of them continued to protest and now are in jail. But you do have a broad mass of youth who were traumatized by that year of Brotherhood rule, who felt that the Brotherhood, on puritanical and religious grounds, wanted to take away a lot of their liberties, and who are willing to go along with what has happened, even are happy about it. But do note that the youth on the whole and by and large didn't vote for the constitution crafted under the authority of General al-Sisi in January of this year, and they didn't vote in large numbers in the presidential election. And so they seem to be displaying a certain amount of dissatisfaction with the return to repression simply by abstaining.
Have you seen any evidence or heard any discussion of maybe covert assistance of these individuals who are fomenting these movements from the international community, training that they might receive from overseas to do what they're trying to do?
Well, that's a fraught question, because the United States and Europe all have democracy promotion projects, mm-hmm. and the kind of young people who have been involved in these protests are obvious candidates for some kind of involvement in democracy promotion. So some leaders of the April 6th youth movement, for instance, came to Washington, testified before Congress, came to New York and met with Freedom House people, as Freedom House is a non-governmental organization that promotes democracy and has a kind of right of center bent. So it's certainly the case that some youth leaders have been involved in these democracy promotion initiatives also in Europe. But I don't think you can read anything off of that. And I think I'm a social historian, and so I'm interested in sort of movements of large numbers of people. I don't think something like what happened in 2011 can be promoted by a few leaders who got training someplace. I think this was a sign of a generational discontent. And that there were many, many movements involved, many organizations. And moreover, to any extent that the West was involved in democracy promotion, it wanted a kind of gradual opening up of things. And the Western governments were very attached to these dictators. The French Minister of Defense at the time actually offered Ben Ali police training when the protests were going on, as if that was what the problem of Tunisia was, that they didn't have good trained police. And we know that members of the Obama administration, like Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden, were very distressed to see the threat to Hosni Mubarak and his overthrow. So, you know, there are conspiracy theories, frankly, in the region that the U.S. was behind all of this or some other foreign country. And that just doesn't make any sense to me.
Do you think the international community of democratic countries has responded appropriately or chosen appropriately not to respond to fraught situations in different places?
No, I don't think that the international community has responded well. I mean, you know, one understands the sensitivities because, for instance, in Egypt, there are these conspiracy theories, especially in the Ministry of Interior, which runs the secret police, that the pro-democratic movements somehow are a conspiracy of foreign powers. And so NGOs have often been raided and members imprisoned. They've been falsely accused of being funded from the outside, and judges have acquitted them of such charges on occasion. And so, you know, revving up a big support effort from the outside for these groups is in a way doomed to undermine them. But on the other hand, I have to say I'm a little bit puzzled that there hasn't been more pro-democracy foreign aid and practical help to these countries. And I think in a way it's unfortunate for them that it occurred. These events began occurring after the 2008-2009 economic crash in Europe and the United States. You have 25% unemployment in Spain and so forth. And so a lot of countries that maybe 5 years earlier might have been very gung-ho about reaching out and helping with the democratic transition had turned inward and didn't feel like they had the resources to do so.
I don't want to gloss over what will surely be a challenging fight, but let's assume for purposes of this discussion that democracy will come to the Arab world. Do you think it will have a fundamentally different shape or character than what we know in the West? And do we need to sort of sensitize ourselves so that we can recognize it when we see it?
Well, I'm not in the business of making predictions. So I don't know whether there will be successful democratic transitions in some of these countries. Certainly, I think there are good signals of such a thing in Tunisia. But Egypt, as we have discussed, has had a big relapse. Politically speaking, things have gone relatively well in Yemen, but the country is otherwise such a security mess that it kind of throws the high politics into the shade. Certainly, I think, democracy is a lot of things, and it's a rule of law. It's regular elections in which there's transparent winners and losers, and the losers go home. That's a very minimal definition, but of course it hasn't been the way that the Middle East has operated for the most part. Then there are all kinds of cultural indicators of democracy and proliferation of non-governmental organizations is one of them. The independence of the judiciary is important and so forth. So I think, you always have a mixed picture in these countries because there can be very substantial popular input into governance, even under what looks like a relatively authoritarian setup. And I would say, for instance, in Egypt, we were talking about how unfortunate the authoritarian plebiscite was that brought General Sisi to president to power as president this spring. But on the other hand, I think Sisi really is genuinely popular right now. So it looks like it must be a dictated result, but I think, the people who didn't like the new situation didn't come out, And when I was there in March, I noticed that people were talking about, you know, it was inevitable that Sisi was going to win because so many people were happy with him. So sometimes what looks to us like an undemocratic result may just be, you know, a great deal of popular enthusiasm for a particular outcome.
Juan Cole is professor of history at the University of Michigan and author of The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. Juan, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Chris, it's been a great conversation.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Pablo Pena. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.